Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 34 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action movie Die Hard, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Matthew Simpson of Awesome Friday. Welcome back, Matthew.
Thank you very much. This has been very fun. I'm looking forward to keeping doing it.
All right, just maybe it should take about two and a half hours, you know, and just for the five mechanicals, though.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's you can't do the last one locally either, so we have to figure something else out.
Right, exactly. So, minute 34 begins with the three busy terrorists working their way through the stuff on the roof, and ends with Hans getting lost in thought. So we continue the rest of the scene that we ended yesterday's minute on, where we have Marco Heinrich and Uli, you know, planting their detonations and wires and all that stuff. I mean, that actually takes up a fair chunk of this minute, just watching them, you know, work together. You know, we see at one point that I mean, first of all, they work well as a team. You know, the dialogue is very sparse because we hear, you know, them say, "Here, Uli," you know, it's like toss things.
Yeah.
You know, like very little really going on here from a dialogue perspective, but from a exposition perspective, this is great because we see that this is hard work. This isn't something that is very trivial. You know, and they want us to realize that despite the fact that we now know these are not terrorists, okay, what they are doing is something that's very complicated, and they're, you know, that the plan is set really well.
Yeah, and they all seem to be, you know, professionals hired for their specific skills.
Right.
And you're right, I think I would have to go back and watch it again, but all this setup takes up probably like a quarter or maybe even a third of this minute of just them.
It takes up about 20. I think it's about 20 seconds.
Yeah. And it's just them laying out detonation cord and planting C4 in places and climbing on pipes and putting, like, it's all,
it's very physical.
What's the right word here? It's very physical. It's also, you might go so far as to call it almost like a dance as they're sort of moving all this stuff around. It's all very precise and everyone seems to understand exactly what to do. Like, it makes clear that they are all, you know, very good at what they're trying to do.
Well, that's actually the reason probably why Hans wanted to send Carl up there, because if it's a dance, you know, Alexander Gudinov was a dancer. So there you go.
He was the primo danseur of the Moscow Ballet, was it? One of the German.
That I don't remember of which ballet, but he was definitely connected to it. There's no question about that. But it's just pretty funny that it just reminded me of it when you said that what they're doing makes them look like they're dancing around, which is great. You know, I mean, I love, for instance, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which, you know, all of the fight scenes look like everyone is dancing, you know, because it's done so fluidly and smoothly and stuff like that. I mean, I'm not a fan of watching movies about dancing and stuff like that, but when you do things like that, it makes a lot of sense, you know, and if you look at the way that they are moving around, they're moving around very fluidly and swiftly, you know, between the pipes and, you know, the way that they're doing everything here just works really well. So yeah, I think you could classify that as a form of dancing. You know, it's terrorist dancing. What would you call that?
Well, thief dancing.
Thief dancing. There you go.
Yeah, I just looked it up. He was a member of the Bolshoi, and he was the premier dancer, and he defected from the USSR to the United States in 1979.
Ooh.
So that's always fun.
Yeah. It's very true. So then after we get to see all of this explosive charges exposition, I guess you can say. So they move us back to the vault, and we get to see, Theo and Hans walk into the area with the vault, and Hans seems very deep in thought, and Theo just starts talking to him and goes, well, 30 minutes to break the code, 2 hours, 2.5 hours for the 5 mechanicals at the minimum. The 7th lock, however, is out of my hands. And, I mean, the way... First of all, I like the fact that the way that they're doing this is to basically tell us their plan, or their plan from a technical perspective. What is it that we're planning on doing? We're going to, we have to break all these codes and we have to, get through the mechanicals. What is a mechanical? My assumption is, they're talking about, when you're breaking into a safe, that's what I would think that they're talking about here, that, you have to get through the dials or whatever you want to call them,
whether you're cracking the code, whether you're cracking the combination or drilling, drilling out the lock. That's my understanding too.
Yeah. But I mean, in general, everything that Theo is saying here is pretty much gibberish. It's technical jargon and gibberish. That's what I would call it. We're not really supposed to understand what it is that they're trying to do here.
Yeah, there's a great Star Trek script term, technobabble, which you could definitely apply to this scene.
Yeah, for sure. I would agree with that. It is techno. I've heard the term technobabble before, and yes, that makes a lot of sense. That's what he's doing here. I mean, it makes sense when you think about what he's talking about, but we don't really know what he's talking about. For him to say, okay, I got to break the code, and then I have, to get through the 5 mechanicals, and that's taking a few hours, and then the 7th lock, and whatever. Takagi mentioned, I think, 7. I think it was mentioned earlier this week about 7 locks, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That even if I gave you the code, you still need to get through the other locks. Yeah, right. Yeah, there's 7 safeguards on the vault.
Right. Yeah, it's only one. He says it's only 1 of 7.
Right.
And then Gruber says, well, then there's no reason not to give it to us.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's nice for them to continue along with this, to keep the continuity of the fact that there are 7 different locks that they need to get through. What exactly are each of these locks? Who knows?
Doesn't really matter either.
Exactly.
We just need to know how long it takes.
Correct. Like
it just helps establish the timeline of the film.
But again, he says at the minimum, and we never really know until what time at what time everything is finished. We know that it's approximately now, let's say 7-8 o'clock at night, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's about as close as we can get to it. I mean, we know that sunset on December 24th, 1988, was at 4:50. Okay, so John showed up at Nakatomi at about 4:45.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so trying to infer how much time passed and stuff like that. So I would say it's probably around 7:30 right now, something like that.
Sure.
At the latest. It might even be earlier. You never know.
It might be. I would still say that, knowing that he needs minimum... So basically he says 3 hours, right? Half an hour for the code and then 2.5 hours for the 5 mechanical locks. So that's going to take us to like 10:30 at night.
Right.
And even if that isn't the timeline of the film, it is the timeline of how long they need to, like, say the police show up 2 minutes later, they need to stall for that long.
Right.
Like, it does create a time pressure for the terrorists that John is actively disrupting for the rest of the film.
But I think it does make sense that it should be around 10 o'clock, because one of the arguments later when they want to cut the power is the fact that it's Christmas Eve, everyone's, with their families at this point. So it can't be like 2 o'clock in the morning. It still needs to be at a relatively normal hour to believe that people are with their families, and that, losing power is going to affect them.
Yeah, for sure. And, 10 o'clock would definitely be the time when kids are in bed and parents are having a before-bed cocktail or maybe wrapping some last-minute presents, that kind of thing.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah.
So, basically, as the You know, first of all, we see another one of the villains standing by waiting to assist. You know, this, I believe his name is Christoph.
Yeah, standing by to assist Theo.
He's a guy who we only see in the vault. You know, throughout the rest of the movie, the only time we'll see him is in the vault, and he actually gets saved because of the fact that he was in the vault. You know, but we'll get there in many months from now when we discuss that.
Yeah, and he just seems to be there to help, to be Theo's like gopher, basically, or lackey.
Yeah, and I mean the shot of the room is amazing. I mean, it's a huge vault, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I still remember on one of the DVDs that I had of this movie, and I've had numerous versions of the DVD over the years. So they had like a little short that explains the difference between widescreen and pan and scan. And they use this scene where, you know, it shows the vault and, you know, it's very different. Actually, no, I'm sorry. They use the scene when the vault gets opened, but they show the vault in that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here, because we're watching it in widescreen, the room looks so much more enormous than if you were doing it in pan and scan.
Absolutely. And especially when they walk into the room and the camera kind of comes around on the vault.
Yeah.
It's kind of an impressive reveal, actually, because it's a really well laid out room. It looks very well appointed. And then this huge door just is revealed. And you realize that, like, oh, the reason he's saying it's going to take 3 hours is that that door looks not just big in terms of like wide and tall, but like it looks impenetrable.
Yeah.
Like it looks thick and difficult to get through.
Yeah. And I love that on the outside of the vault, it looks like there are lights. And they actually look like, you know, Star Trek transporter room tubes or something like that. The way that they're, you know, I saw that when I was doing my research for the show. I was like, oh, wow, Matthew's the perfect person to talk about, you know, a transporter room in Nakatomi Plaza.
I mean, and if there was ever going to be a place in 1988 that a transporter existed, Nakatomi Plaza would probably be the place.
There you go. That makes sense. but
or in the real world, it would be like Sony headquarters or something. But you know, it's same.
Well, 20th Century Fox. You know, that's what it is. This is you know, 20th Century Fox. It's 20th Century Fox's home office. You know, in Century City. So there you go. That's where it is.
Yeah.
Maybe they are real transporters. You never know.
That would be amazing. Can't wait until my commute is get out of bed and step on a pad.
Right. And I mean, then we get a shot of there's like a computer console or a digital console right on the outside of the vault where we see things moving along there. We don't know what's written there. We're too far away to actually tell what's going on, but it looks very futuristic for 1988. The way
and I think it's there. Also
again, it's the controls for the transporter. So there you go.
Yeah, for sure. And it's also, I think it's actually a nice piece of visual storytelling. They've been talking enough about having to break a code that even without getting a close up on that screen, you know exactly what it's for and what was about to happen with it, right?
Yeah.
It's the film is very well laid out that way. There's very few things that don't have a ton of setup ahead of their reveals, right?
Mm-hmm.
That Kuleshov effect of like, you know, two shots having more meaning than like the inferred meaning between two shots. This film is very good at that. It's very economical, would be a word for it, I think.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And then, you know, we see that Hans was sort of paying attention to Theo, but not really. You know, you think he's like awestruck by the way that that this vault looks? Because my assumption is that, you know, he's never seen what the vault looks like. He's maybe seen the plans of the building or and stuff, but he hasn't seen the actual room itself. And he's even someone like Hans can be awestruck by this.
That is 100% my read on the scene as well. When Theo is explaining things and Hans has to be like, I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. Because he comes around the corner and sees the vault for the first time. And whether he's awestruck by the impressiveness of the vault or because he knows what's inside the vault, like he's finally, you know, just a few feet away from his goal.
Right.
There's definitely a feeling of he's taking in the beauty of the moment for sure.
Right. I mean, if this was a cartoon, we would see like the dollar signs in his eyes.
Or they'd come out of his head and, you know, enlarge.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he goes, I'm sorry. And then Theo responds to him, the seventh lock. You know, like, hello, I was just talking about the seventh lock. So I love the way that Theo emphasizes it, that this is our biggest hurdle. This is what we need to get through. You know, tomorrow we'll get a little bit of an explanation as to what this seventh lock really is. You know, again, it'll be a little more technical babble, but we'll still, you know, they'll still try and explain it to us with the whole thing. But it's just done really well.
Yeah, everything about this scene is done really well, and it's another moment of just like I said, like. He's about to set something up that's going to pay off in a later scene.
Right. And one of the good things I like about this episode is it establishes for us the relationship between Theo and Hans here also. Theo is not afraid to tell Hans what he needs and what he wants.
Mm.
You know, there's no intimidation here. You know, we don't hear Theo apologizing. You know, Theo's talking and then it's Hans who's apologizing, saying, I wasn't paying attention, not repeat what you just said. You know, it's more of the relationship between the two of them is a lot more smooth, is much smoother than one would think.
Yeah, it's definitely, and as with Carl as well, it's very much one more of, you know, their peers rather than like sort of boss and subordinate.
Right.
And probably because, you know, Theo is, even just by what we've seen of him, we sort of know he's a whiz at this kind of stuff. And you don't bring around the best and then treat him like just a regular henchman, right? Like
right.
He's a specialist.
That's right.
And you treat him as such.
Right. But on like the other hand, you still want to make sure that, you know, things get done properly.
True. But if you know, if we were going to take bets on, let's say the plan succeeded and they all got away, and we were going to take bets on which people were going to survive and which people were going to get killed, so they had to split it up so many ways, Theo would definitely be a survivor.
Yeah,
like you know, him and Hans and Carl, and I guess maybe Heinrich and Tony would be what the five probably. Everyone else would probably be pretty expendable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, no, I think you just even say the top three. You don't even have to go beyond that. Everyone else is expendable. You know, it's Hans, Carl, sorry, you got to, well, okay, if Tony is Hans's brother, so then you got to go with four. I don't know if Heinrich, I'm not sure if Heinrich would be on that list or not. He might be.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, actually. I only included him because he sounds German like Carl and Tony do.
No, but Tony doesn't really sound like a very German name, but whatever. That goes back to the book where he's, I think, Italian. I think this is the name comes. And Tony, I think, is Carl, if I remember correctly from the book. I could be wrong about that. Like, I got to finish rereading it one of these days.
Yeah. I've never actually read the book, but I've always kind of always meant to.
Yeah.
But
it's very different, but it has a lot of elements that were used in the script, which is what's really cool when you read it. So do you have anything else you want to mention about this minute before we get to the script?
No, I'm good.
All right. So the script basically just has it's just a few lines because obviously not that much happens in this particular minute here. But I love the description of the vault room. It says, Hans and Theo enter the safe room. The huge corporate safe looms in front of them. Theo places three kit bags onto a table and rolls up his sleeves. He swivels a computer console into handy reach and sits down. You know, so again, he still mentions, you know, they mentioned that he's here sitting at some sort of console to take care of all this other everything he's doing. It's not the two of them walking. I like the fact that they're walking. You know, they're doing a walk and talk. They're doing a West Wing walk and talk here.
Yeah, an Aaron Sorkin special.
Yeah, which works.
I think that the scene definitely would not be as effective if Theo was sitting down at all. Like, right. I think it works better because they're standing sort of eye to eye, and Theo is like, here's what I can do, and the one thing I can't, and it's sort of important that they're on equal footing for that.
Yeah. And then there's a slight discrepancy in what Theo says in the script. He goes, 30 minutes to break the code, 2 hours for the 5 mechanicals. So, you know, he doesn't say 2, 2.5. He's being much more precise. But I like the fact that in the final cut, he's less precise because he's showing that, you know, I'm going to do my best, but it could take 2 hours. It could take 2.5 hours. You know, there's certain things that are beyond my control.
Yeah, exactly. Like the plans might not be complete or exactly what they're expecting.
Yeah.
Or something might have been reinforced or something. It's also just expectations management. You know, like if it takes me a little longer, it takes me a little longer. Like it's just right. It's going to take as long as it's going to take.
Yeah. Right. So that's pretty much the only discrepancies that they have here in the script. All right. So every Thursday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Holiday Edition, where either my guest or myself will give a little story about an adventure, a misadventure, or something fun that might have happened to one of us over some sort of holiday. So today everyone's going to get another story from me. So I remember as a kid now, you know, anyone who knows me, they know that I'm a religious Jew. So, you know, I don't celebrate Christmas. And so I remember as a kid, you know, people always make jokes that Jews go out to Chinese restaurants on Christmas Eve. But we never did that. What we did is when I was a kid on Christmas Eve, that was the night we always went to the movie theater. The movie theater was empty. It was always open, but it was empty. And the one movie that always stands out in my mind that I saw on Christmas Eve was Clue. Okay, I remember that Clue came out in 1985, so I was 11 at the time, and I remember the big thrill of going to see Clue at the time was that you know it was advertised they have three different endings, and depending on which viewing you went to or which theater you went to, you would get a different ending for that particular movie, and randomly, the one we went to was ending number C, which was the ending where everybody did it. Okay, so now I've seen Clue numerous times since then. First of all, I loved watching it. You know, I'd always played. You know, we played the games all the time, and to be able to see them take a board game and make a story and a movie out of it was great to watch. You know, now I can appreciate it a lot more than I could when I was 11, obviously, because now I know all the actors and I know everything. You know, I know a lot more about the game of Clue and how things work. Mm-hmm. But what's great is when I rewatch it now. So, you know, you on the final cut, whether it's on video or DVD or whether it's in a digital copy. So, you know, they put all three endings together. You know, they show you the first ending and then they say, well, that could have happened, but maybe this happened. And then they have the second ending and then they go, well, maybe that also could have happened, but this is what really happened. And I always find a satisfaction to the fact that the version that they claim is what really happened is the one that I saw in the theater. So for me, that was always the true ending to the movie. So the way that they put it together, you know, that in the end, it's every one of the characters, you know, murdered somebody. Sorry to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen Clue at this point. But so I just like the way that they did that. And for me, I guess you can say that that's a Christmas memory for someone like me who doesn't celebrate Christmas. So
I'm sort of envious, to be totally honest, because I wasn't old enough to see it when it came out in theaters, but I have seen Clue roughly a bazillion times, and I've only ever seen it with all three endings. And I'm always sort of impressed at how ambitious that plan would have been to release the movie three different ways in the 80s. Like now it seems like it'd be a really easy thing to do, but in the 80s that means cutting three different versions of the print, right? So and also I kind of wonder how it would play without the all three endings, because I've only ever seen it with all three endings. So
Right. Well, that's the thing.
such a
I've never seen the other two endings on their own either. That's the thing.
yeah.
You know, because I wasn't going to go spend money to go see it again because I've already seen the movie and I've seen the real ending. You know, why do I want to see another ending? That type of thing. And again, it came out months later, you know, on video, so I was able to then see all of the endings that the or was on cable or whatever. You know, so I saw all the endings that, you know, just a few months later. But yeah, no, that's one of the things that I always miss, the nostalgia of being able to see certain things in the theater. Like you mentioned before that you saw Die Hard, you know, on Christmas, you know, in your in your local theater just, you know, 10, 15 years ago. You know, for me, I was I'd love to do that. I'd love to be able to, you know, see some great movies once again in the theater. You know, have that experience again. I mean, I brought this up in the past, but probably last season I brought this up. But I remember that when Saving Private Ryan came out, I saw it in the theater and I loved it. I was amazed by it. And then a few weeks later, a friend of mine called me up and said, "You want to go see Saving Private Ryan with me?" And I said, "I already saw it." And he goes, "You definitely want to come see it with me again." He says, "This is a movie that we will never have the opportunity to see on such a large screen again. And we should take the opportunity of being able to see it again." Again, I love Saving Private Ryan. It's one of my favorite movies. You know, I don't mind watching it on any size screen. That doesn't make a difference. But there definitely is something to seeing it on, you know, the big screen. You know, there's
I
no question about that.
100%. Yep,
You
there's
know,
really
it's
something magical about it, isn't there?
yeah, and it's unfortunate that it, and it doesn't matter where you live. Maybe LA, it's different from what I remember. You know, my friend Richard Kirkham talks about that in LA there are tons of theaters that show movies, you know, on the big screen again, you know, things that are older. But in most
Yep.
cities, it's rare. You'll get something every once in a while. You know, it's
Yeah.
not a common thing. So, you know, what can you do? Well, at least we get to still see the movies, you know, even if you don't get to see them on the
True.
big screen.
Well, if you ever make it to Vancouver, one thing that happens every summer is that the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra puts on movies and they play the score live.
Oh yeah,
So,
I saw Raiders that way a few years back. I
yeah.
would love to. There's tons of movies that I mean, I see all the time all these different movies that you know, they've done. You know, the original trilogy of Star Wars, and they've done Back to the Future. I've heard that they've done The Godfather. You know, there's like a group of movies that they constantly do over and over. You know, different symphonies play them. So yeah,
Yeah,
that.
one of the best ones I ever saw was they did The Wizard of Oz.
Ooh,
It was wonderful to watch with the symphony live.
interesting. The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. There you go. All right,
Yeah, it was
great.
great.
All right. So Matthew, you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Yes, the best way to find me online is to check out our website, which is awesomefriday.ca. You can find all of our writing and our podcast, and the podcast can be found pretty much anywhere that you can listen to podcasts. You can find us on the socials at awesomefridayca on Instagram and on Twitter, and Awesome Friday on Facebook. And you can find me mostly on Twitter at smathuaf.
All right. And finding me once again is quite simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. And you can go to my website, movierobminute.com. So, Matthew, you feel like coming back again tomorrow to finish off the week?
Sure do.
All right. Excellent. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.